Hello and welcome to Politico's 2016 Nerdcast, where we bring you the stories behind the stories and geek out on this amazing circus of an election. It's Thursday, September 15th, and I'm Kristen Roberts, National Editor. Here are the numbers that mattered this week. 5. That's the number of battleground states where Donald Trump is now within 2 points of Hillary Clinton. 46. That's the percentage Trump is winning among white women, and it's not enough if he wants to win. 5.2 million. That's how much Priorities USA spent on ads this week, and it's going to climb to 11 million per week by Election Day. And 58%, Obama's approval rating, and the reason Clinton is so eager to get him out on the trail for her. Grab your calculators and enjoy the 2016 Nerdcast. Here we go again. Hello, Charlie Matassian.
Hi, Kristen.
Hello, Hadass Gold.
Hello.
Hello, Scott Bland.
Greetings.
And a very special welcome to one of my favorite reporters, Shane Goldmacher.
This feels familiar and new at the same time.
Eli is out on the trail with Trump. And Ken, someone please alert the competition, or don't actually, is taking a break. We have another great question from one of our listeners. Let's say hi to Betsy from Philadelphia.
Betsy!
Betsy, what's your question?
My question is about the contrast of the campaign management skills of the nominees. Back in 2008, when Hillary Clinton ran a pretty scattered campaign that she got a lot of criticism. That was a big argument against her, that if she couldn't manage a campaign, how could she be the chief executive? And now she's running a really great, tight campaign, and we have Trump all over the place, changing operatives every couple of weeks, and nobody seems to be questioning his executive ability.
It's a good question.
Why is that?
Yeah, Charlie, what's the answer there?
Well, it's really interesting. It's a question that doesn't get nearly enough attention during presidential campaigns. That is the question of what the operation or functioning of a campaign reveals about a candidate's management style or ability to run large enterprises. And I think Betsy's on the money here to talk about the differences between Hillary Clinton's 2008 campaign, which was marked by staff dysfunction and backbiting and lots of drama, and the current one that, as best as we can tell, has very little drama, appears to be a lot more disciplined and smoothly running. And I think if she's not getting the kind of credit that Betsy's talking about, at least in the media, I suspect it's for a couple reasons. The first is that, first of all, it's a really hard story to write. Brooklyn is very hard to penetrate deeply because it's so disciplined this time around, and we don't exactly know how well it's being managed. We just have snippets and, you know, we have a feel for it. You know, on the one hand, you see that they were very resolute during the primary season. They were resolute against adversity, and they seemed to stick to their operational plan. You didn't see a whole lot of panic, at least not publicly. But then again, on the other hand, you've got a candidate who is running against probably the most unpopular candidate of my lifetime, at least. So the level of success she's having is sort of in question. I think ultimately, as for Trump, the Trump part of this equation, which is Trump's management style, I think I agree that the constant disarray in his campaign isn't getting nearly the attention it deserves. The constant infighting, the wild careening path it's taken, the rival power centers, the organizational disarray, the inability, at least until recently, to attract top talent, the inability to plan or execute, all of that really doesn't inspire confidence about what will happen if he takes over a sprawling enterprise like the federal government. So I think ultimately, I do think voters are giving Hillary Clinton some credit, at least, because at least in the polls, what we can see is that the voters seem to think that she's more prepared and more competent to run the enterprise than Donald Trump.
Yeah, the one thing I would add to that also is that it seems like this argument that if you have proven that you can run a campaign, then that proves that you can run the country, seems to come up when there's kind of a more, you know, inexperienced type candidate trying to make that argument for themselves that they're running a better campaign. In John Dickerson's new book, Whistle Stop, he essentially kind of blames John F. Kennedy for the creation of this idea that when Kennedy was running in 1960 and he was an inexperienced congressman, his campaign really put forward this argument that he was running this great tight campaign, and that proved that he could run a national enterprise. And you fast forward to Barack Obama running for president in 2008, inexperienced member of Congress, former state legislator, but you know, this was his opportunity to show that he could run a national enterprise. Clinton doesn't really need to lean on the fact that she's running a tight campaign as something in her favor. You know, she has this experience as Secretary of State and as Senator and First Lady and all this stuff. It's not something that I don't think they feel like they need to lean on the way that, you know, someone like Kennedy or Obama had to.
Betsy, thank you so much for your email and for listening.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Let's go to our first data point. It is 5. That's the number of battleground states where Donald Trump is now within 2 points of Hillary Clinton, according to our polling averages. Now, Charlie, this feels like a dead heat nationally. Is it that way in the states?
Yeah, I think people need to wrap their arms around the idea that Donald Trump can win this thing. That's what all the recent polling suggests. And the numbers you're talking about are not the national polls that we've seen in the last couple of days. We're talking about the battleground states that are essential to for Donald Trump to find a path to win the presidency. It's really remarkable how they're closing. I mean, it is a dead tie. And when I say dead tie, I'm talking about down to the tenths of a percentage point in several of our battleground states in the averages, that is, in Florida, in Ohio. Those are dead ties. Then you've got a couple of other states, North Carolina, Nevada, Iowa, where Trump is either up or within a couple of points. So this is a real election, and he now has a path to win.
So, Shane, jump in here. If these numbers are correct, what is Trump's most likely path?
The way I see it, Trump has two paths. The more likely path is carrying almost every state or every state that Mitt Romney won, the most competitive of which is North Carolina. And then he has to win the three biggest swing states. That's Florida, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. If he does those two things, he gets to 273 electoral votes. That's the easiest and fastest path for him. Easy is sort of a relative term because he's losing in Pennsylvania in most polls still by a fair margin. The second path he has is if he loses Pennsylvania, he carries North Carolina, Ohio, and Florida. The way he gets to 270 that way, he has to win Iowa, he has to win Nevada, he has to win New Hampshire, and one of Maine's two electoral votes. That gets him exactly to 270. And guess what? Donald Trump is up in two polls this week in Maine's second district, in one poll by 10 percentage points. So it's not, he basically has two paths. The first is win Pennsylvania. If he loses that, he has to win in four other places to make up for losing Pennsylvania.
Except, so I was actually just about to bring up that Maine thing, which is totally fascinating, but there's also a chance he could lose Nebraska too, which is the Omaha congressional district, because Nebraska also allocates its electoral votes, one per district. And in fact, the Nebraska Democratic Party was just touting yesterday that they've taken a voter registration lead in Douglas County, where Omaha is, for the first time in a little while. They've registered over 6,000 voters in the last, you know, however long this some period this year, and they now outnumber Republicans in that county. So there's this Nebraska
as Clinton's firewall.
Yeah, right. And it gets back to something we've talked about on the podcast before, right? About the education split between what's going on now. Maine too is like pretty rural, pretty blue collar, and it's a district where Democrats did a lot worse than they thought they were going to in the 2014 midterm elections. I think because of some of these changes that are going on in the electorate that predate Trump and that Trump is now accelerating, whereas Nebraska too and some of these other congressional districts that they're targeting this time around are a lot more white collar. There's kind of big splits going on between voting groups so far in the polls we're seeing.
So I'm going to ask a question that I am increasingly thinking is a stupid question in this cycle, but what does his organization look like in the states that he needs to win? And really, does it even matter?
There's a fun anecdote about Maine's second congressional district, which is the more competitive of the two. Donald Trump has campaigned in Maine a couple of times. One of the times wasn't in that district, right? Mm-hmm. If you're going to win a seat, you probably want to campaign in that district, and that tells you a lot about his organization. For a long time, he's had zero offices in North Carolina. He is behind Clinton in most of these states, despite the RNC's protestations that they have all of these people and offices melding in numbers from state-level committees and national committees and state-level campaigns. But as to whether it matters, it doesn't seem like it's mattered yet, but it doesn't matter until you start getting people to the polls, and that's happening in only a few weeks.
We don't even need to beat around the bush about his organization. Not that I'm suggesting you're beating around the bush at all. I mean, this is a really easy one. His organization is crap. It's rubbish. It doesn't exist. It's unlike anything we've seen in the modern era. And they would be the first, well, I was going to say they would be the first people to tell you that. They won't tell
they
you
won't.
That.
They won't
but they that. Will acknowledge that they are operating at a very different level than other campaigns. And what I mean by that is if you look at 2004, the Bush reelection campaign, if you look at 2008, the Obama first win, those are looked at as the gold standard of American campaigns. They are, by any reckoning, two of the best campaigns that were ever run. And they were highly sophisticated. They were excellent at execution. They embraced modern techniques, data analytics, micro-targeting, everything. They were great campaigns. Trump basically is trying to throw the old adage on its ear that campaigns matter. They believe that big rallies suggest more about his popularity than anything. And in fact, what was really revealing was there was a statement by his Florida campaign director who came out and said that 40,000 people at a rally are exactly the same as 40,000 door knocks, which I think a lot of campaign pros would be shocked to hear. But either way, it reflects their mindset that this is a different kind of election. This is a unique lightning in a bottle candidate, and all the traditional metrics like campaign organization no longer apply.
Scott.
One thing that Trump has right now, though, that a campaign organization can't necessarily buy you is voter intensity, voter enthusiasm. And we've seen in some of the polls that are coming out this week that his voters right now are a lot more enthusiastic than Clinton's voters. And so a couple things to say about that. First of all, that plays into these polls, right? Polling, we talked about before, polling is getting harder and harder and harder. And it's a lot easier to get people to respond to a poll if they are excited and think their candidate is winning. So we shouldn't discount that as you know, playing a role in what the polling is right now. But secondly, we're seeing this week Hillary Clinton's campaign is dispatching Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren to Ohio and probably to some other states too to try and rev things up a little bit on her behalf as she gets back out on the trail.
One important thing that I forgot to mention, and it's an important thing to keep in mind, is while they don't have their own traditional organization or field office apparatus, what's notable here is that they are allowing the RNC to fill in the gap. So it's not like they have no organization. It is that the RNC, they're relying to a much greater degree on the national party and also on the state parties in the states where there are strong state party infrastructures. They're relying on those folks to do the field organization that campaigns have done traditionally.
Let's talk about the Q poll. I think it was a really important poll, a lot of fascinating data. Let's look at one number. It's the number 46. That's the percentage Donald Trump is winning among white women. Why is this a problem for him, Charlie?
Well, it's a big problem because he's not winning by enough. If you take a look at 2012, for example, Mitt Romney killed it. Well, I don't know about killed it, but ran very well among white women.
He won certainly 56. Didn't kill it, though.
Yeah, he didn't. He won comfortably among white women. He won 56 to 42. Donald Trump is not even winning among white women. He's down, according to that poll, I think the New York Times poll that came out today. It's a tie between Trump and Clinton, and he cannot win as long as his numbers are that weak with white women.
Shane, jump in here. When you looked at this Q poll, what jumped out to you as important?
I think there were two things that jumped out to me. One is the party registration numbers. So Hillary Clinton is winning 92% of Democrats, and Trump is getting 4% of Democrats, and Trump is winning 86% of Republicans. He cannot trail her by 6 percentage points in his own party if he's going to compete. This poll has him winning independents, right? So for all of the problems around his campaign and the controversies, he is beating her among independent voters. His problem is he is still losing comparatively among Republicans as she is to Democrats. So that's the first thing that stands out to me. And the other is Hillary Clinton's problem with young people, which is we talked about Bernie Sanders going to Ohio. Donald Trump is in third place among young people in this poll, behind Gary Johnson. But the problem for Hillary Clinton is Johnson is taking nearly a third of the young people's vote, and she needs to be winning young voters by a big margin. So if there's a warning sign for Donald Trump among white women, the big warning sign for Hillary Clinton here for me is that she is not doing nearly as well as she needs to be within the margin of error of being tied among young voters.
You know, it seems like the Trump campaign is reading these numbers in a way that his rhetoric is about his disdain for polls doesn't really bear out. I mean, the things that they're doing on the trail reflect a desire to reach out to independents, to lock them down, to actually even reach out to white suburban women. Is that what you're seeing?
Yeah, I think a good example of that is the child care proposal rollout that came the other day. That came in my in the Philadelphia suburbs. It came in Delaware County in a place called Aston. And it's no coincidence that Donald Trump rolled out his proposal there with Ivanka at his side, because the Philadelphia suburbs are not only essential to his bid to win Pennsylvania, but they're indicative of a lot of once Republican suburbs surrounding some of the major cities in this country that have become swingy or are leaning Democratic. And he's not doing as well as he needs to as a Republican.
He's getting whacked there now by like 18 percentage points, according to the last poll in Pennsylvania that came out yesterday. And it was astonishing.
Yeah, and part of that is suburban women. And so that's why he showed up there. So clearly they know where their weak spots are, which reflects the increasing professionalism and discipline that the campaign is showing. I don't know how long they can sustain this, but they're following a little more discipline and rigor than they have in the past.
You know, it's affecting the way the Clinton people are running things too. I mean, we spent all of last weekend talking about this deplorables mistake. Was it a mistake? Was it not a mistake? And as the days passed, we find Clinton people saying, campaign people and allies saying, you know what, maybe we should just own this. Maybe we should use it as a way to convince these suburban white women that really that discomfort you feel about getting behind Donald Trump's campaign, that's appropriate.
I mean, that's what you've seen in Hillary Clinton's paid television advertisements and the paid television advertisements of her super PAC. They've targeted women voters from the get-go. They featured mothers talking with their husbands. They featured children. You know, this has very much been the target audience from the beginning of not just their earned media efforts and what they talk about on the stump, but what they're paying to put in front of people, which tells you a lot about their priorities.
The one thing that I want to end this segment with from the Q poll is the idea that the pollsters put into their press release, which I think is on the money, and that's most Americans are voting against a candidate this cycle rather than for a candidate. And I think really what that means is that every misstep has an outsized influence. It has more influence than it would have in previous cycles. And so when we see Clinton make a mistake, when we see her fall down in a New York City street, it's going to have a bigger effect on the numbers than it probably would have in any other contest.
And in fact, to that point, what we've seen, Gallup has been asking people, you know, have you seen news about Hillary Clinton? Have you seen news about Donald Trump recently? The person who scores higher on that tends to be losing the polls at that moment. This is one of the few times this summer as there's been news about Clinton's pneumonia and the episode she had at the September 11th memorial that she's been out-media-ing Trump, and her polls are doing badly.
Let's get to our next data point, 5.2 million. That's how much Priorities USA spent this week, and it's going to climb to 11 million a week by Election Day. Scott, it's one thing to be dropping cash, but are these ads even effective?
Yeah, see, that's a really interesting question, and you can answer this now. There are companies, and there's one in particular that releases a lot of data on this called Asemetrics, where they get online panels together that they wait to look like the electorate, and this is a company that's used by corporations that are looking to test their own ads before they air them, but also increasingly by campaigns. The Romney campaign used it in 2012. There are a number of other political clients, and what they do, you know, they show ads to this panel of people, and they get a bunch of scores back, and people use that to look at them. And what we're seeing is, you know, some of the ads that we've been hearing a lot and talking about a lot recently that certainly have been making a lot of news in D.C. Kind of suck. According to these scores, they're not really doing much.
Like, which ones are terrible?
Well, so for example, we talked about the deplorables comment that Clinton made, mm-hmm. right? So the Trump campaign had a much ballyhooed ad response to that, pushing back on this idea. How dare you? And according to these scores, you know, it's scoring, you know, 20-25% less than the average effectiveness on these. And now, one grain of salt on these ratings, right, is that typically it's difficult to get a negative ad to score well. Even though people say it works, people don't like to you know, respondents don't like to say that they like them.
Oh, that's interesting.
But even among negative ads, it's not scoring particularly well. Neither is the Clinton response ad to that response ad. Neither is the Priorities USA ad featuring Ronald Reagan that we've heard so much about how, you know, Trump is no heir to Reagan. And we can actually play a clip of that right now.
We are one nation under God, the black and white. We are all Americans.
I'd like to punch him in the face. I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters.
This ad scores 15% below the norm for political ads, according to the Asymmetric score. So, you know, again and again, we're not, and I think part of this gets back to what we just talked about people voting against these candidates. You know, I don't think anyone is particularly excited or primed to see an ad and then go out and say, oh, you know what? Yeah, like now I'm excited about, you know, voting the other way, voting against this person, whatever. Like, people just aren't all that into this election, it seems like.
So, I mean, we also just, I don't feel like we've seen as many positive ads this election. So much of the ads that get a lot of the attention are, for example, the Hillary Clinton ads where it's just Trump's voice and then it's a bunch of children watching him, or it's the veteran. This is like a theme they do, and then they have like veterans watching Donald Trump make comments about other veterans, because it just feels like this election is all about don't vote for the other guy. But this data seems to show that actually the positive ads work better than negative ads.
Well, so campaign professionals would tell you that that's not true, right? And you have to, I think even the folks who conduct these studies that you have to calibrate a little bit within the positive ads do always score better, but there was a time and a place for them that seems to have passed, right? Like Clinton was running a lot of them in the swing states in June and July, I think, before the convention, and we're pretty much past that at this point.
Well, Hadass makes a pretty good point. If you think about, name a positive Donald Trump television ad, and guess what? There haven't been any, because his first television ad came out and it was a contrast ad. The super PAC ads, such as they were, the NRA, his small amount of super PACs have been either negative ads for the most part. And now one of Trump's super PACs has converted and said they're going to do positive ads, and this is their pitch to donors. Trump isn't doing it. We can do it. But there have been like almost no positive messaging for Donald Trump on paid media, and it's September already. And guess what? The ad rates go up after September, early September. Those super PACs are paying, you know, 5 cents for every 1 cent the Clinton campaign is paying, you know, for every single ad at this point, and sometimes more.
Let's talk a bit about that super PAC then, because it seems like the Trump family is making a lot of moves this week to get donors focused on one super PAC. What are we seeing, Shane?
Well, Eric Trump went for the first time a family member to a super PAC fundraiser this week in New York City. Donors, big donors, have been completely and totally confused by this campaign and where they want them to cut their big checks. Over the summer, the preferred super PAC appeared to be Rebuilding America Now, which is run by Ken McKay, who briefly worked for the Trump campaign. Paul Manafort basically blessed that super PAC. He called into a fundraiser during the RNC convention in Cleveland. When they were having this meeting, supporters of the other super PAC, the Great America PAC, were in the lobby trying to grab donors on the way in and tell them actually we're the real super PAC. And then Manafort called this one.
I know, that was an amazing moment.
I mean, talk about infighting. That's not how it's supposed to work, which you say about so many things in this campaign. But this week, the Trump family went to a super PAC fundraiser for the Great America PAC. And now Eric Trump attending, that's a little bit of an arm's distance for Trump himself, but not much. You see
not
the
much.
Role his kids have in the campaign. So maybe this is a signal for candidates that are for donors that this is where they should give. But that PAC's not running real television ads either. Right now they're on a bus tour. So I think Donald Trump is more or less on his own on the airwaves as he's been all year.
I mean, it's also just so funny when you think back to the primaries and how Donald Trump was speaking about super PACs and how he's not beholden to them, to now have his son be speaking at one of these meetings and seem to have support or be supporting these super PACs. But whether or not these super PACs are putting up ads up, and we're talking about positive ads versus negative ads, it doesn't seem to be having any effect on the polling, really.
Well, I mean, hold on a second. I keep coming back to this idea that Hillary Clinton at this point, given the kind of campaign she's running and the organization she has and the spending, the money she has and how they're spending it, both the campaign and the affiliated super PAC, she should be winning outright.
Right.
Right? This should not be in the margin at all. And, you know, really, I think we need to look at what's happening in this very moment. While we're recording this, Hillary Clinton is getting ready to emerge from 4 days of darkness after her felling by pneumonia on Sunday. This should not be underplayed. This is an opportunity for her campaign to attempt some kind of reset. Can she turn this around? And the way they're going to try to do that is, of course, through the ad spending. But it also has to be a different kind of message from her, because what we're seeing and what the ad spending data tells us and what the ground game stuff we talked about a few minutes tells us is that it doesn't matter what he does. She can't count on him self-destructing to win, which has been her entire game plan for 2 months.
This has been like a little overlooked thing this week. Was after that healthcare proposal, Donald Trump had a front page story on the New York Times about his proposal. He drove positive news coverage with something he did. He's gotten tons of front page stories, very few front page New York Times stories, off a proposal he made, specifically appealing to a group he needs to appeal to. That's a danger sign for the Clinton campaign, that his campaign is learning slowly how to actually generate positive news coverage. He's gotten tons of coverage for controversy, but he's actually starting to get coverage for things he wants coverage of.
Well, he's also becoming a little bit more restrained. Today, we saw him starting to be a little bit more, you know, I don't know if Hillary Clinton can handle things about her health care, but in the first day, you know, first few days of the pneumonia diagnosis and the moment of, or, you know, her wobbling, he didn't say anything. He didn't tweet anything, which everybody was very surprised to see that he didn't come out that way. And it was to his
phone was at the bottom of a fish tank somewhere in Trump Tower.
They, you know, deactivated the Twitter account. But it was surprising. A lot of people said, wow, like, that's very presidential. All he said was just like,
it's very presidential. He didn't tweet.
These are the bars that we're working at, you know, where, you know, if he doesn't tweet something late at night about her and about her health and just says, you know, in, when asked, I just hope she gets better or something like that, that's great for him. I mean, when you set the bar that low.
All right. I'm going to give you another data point. It's 441. That's Trump's testosterone level. Now, you can hear that I'm a little bit laughing because it is one of the numbers that they decided to highlight in his report. And immediately, I turned to the reporters around me and the other editors around me. I said, look it up, because it's going to be way above average. What do you think it was? Do you think it was above average, Shane?
I'm going to defer to the experts and pivot, just as Trump is starting to do now that he has a more disciplined campaign, and say, I'm not a doctor.
It's actually perfectly normal, but I thought it was going to be way above average, wouldn't you?
I'm disappointed. I thought it was going to be Bigley.
It's awful. He doesn't say Bigley. Can we stop doing this?
He doesn't say Bigley?
No.
He
How
says
many
both.
Times do we
he
have to have both. This conversation? You are wrong. Look, I talked to the campaign. They say that he's saying Big League.
Campaign says a lot of things.
Let's go to our next data point. It's our last data point of this show. 58%. Obama's approval rating in the new Washington Post poll. It's his highest since early in his first term. Shane, why do I care?
I think that that's probably the single most important number of the 2016 campaign. Hillary Clinton is more likely to be president if Barack Obama's approval rating is above 50. The farther it is above 50, the more likely she is. Now, 58 is a bit of an outlier compared to some of the other polls recently. His approval rating could be in the low 50s or the mid 50s. Those are all good places for her to be, because whether she likes to say it or not, she is running for Barack Obama's third term. Her policies have embraced most of his policies. She's talked about amplifying
them. Your inbox is going to blow up after that comment from Clinton campaign officials.
Third term.
Go on.
It's just the truth. She doesn't want to talk about it, but that is how she has run her campaign. There's a reason that she had Barack Obama come out and she came out on stage and they hugged each other in Philadelphia. You don't hug each other if you're not trying to run on their coattails.
A literal embrace.
Scott, you like are itching to jump into.
I keep thinking back to 2000 when Bill Clinton's numbers were soaring and Al Gore wanted nothing to do with him. During the race and ended up losing by, you know, a tiny number of votes in Florida, lost his home state in Tennessee, lost Arkansas, you know, lost West Virginia. et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and all these places where people looking back have said, boy, wouldn't it have been helpful if the popular Democratic president was out on the trail making the case for you about how you need to continue this good thing that's going. And it does not look like the Clinton campaign is eager to make that mistake.
Hadass, let's talk about surrogates. What makes a good surrogate? What makes a bad surrogate?
Well, what's really interesting for the surrogates is that you need somebody that like has the high approval rating that people really want to see, and somebody who is in demand, I guess. And this is something that our colleague Annie Carney wrote about, going through pretty much the surrogates and their tiers. And it turns out Bill Clinton is not really as in demand and isn't considered necessarily as big of a surrogate as others. For example, Barack and Michelle Obama, who with Barack's, Barack, I'm talking like I'm his BFF,
with Barry's,
with President Obama's high approval ratings and the fact that he's just not out there as often as acting as a surrogate, he's more in demand. When he comes out there, it's a big deal. It's the sitting president, you know, on the trail. Bill Clinton just doesn't seem to be having the same effect. And Annie reported that in terms of the demands that the campaign is getting for surrogates, he's second place compared to the others.
Yeah, he's right in line with the number of asks that the campaign receives for Tim Kaine, for example.
Which is shocking considering how the two are so different in their campaigning styles and their speaking styles, and just the fact that it's Tim Kaine versus Bill Clinton.
We've come a little bit of a way since Bill Clinton was the secretary of explaining stuff for Obama
right.
in 2012, right?
But you know, the most powerful surrogate is probably Michelle Obama. I mean, everyone looked back at that convention and thought she had the best moment of the whole thing, and she's not going out on the trail. I mean, she will this week, but she's really been reluctant, it seems.
She didn't go out on a trail a lot in 2014. She was one of the few people the Democrats wanted during the midterms. In 2012, she did a bit for her husband. She does not seem to really enjoy going out and campaigning. She's resisted it over the entirety of his presidency and saved her chits and saved her popularity for her husband. And Hillary Clinton is not as close to Michelle Obama as Barack Obama.
Let's talk about Donald Trump's surrogates. Okay, who are they and are they any good and can you be better than Donald Trump? No, right?
I mean, yeah, Donald Trump is his best surrogate. And in Mike Pence, though, is a good surrogate, is a good, every time I have seen him, you know, at rallies and speeches, I've heard from a lot of Republican operatives, like, can we flip the tickets? Can we have it be like Mike Pence versus like a Tim Kaine or something like that? Although I don't know about the Democrats with Tim Kaine, but they see Mike Pence as a disciplined person who, you know, has bona fide conservative credentials, bona fide, you know, evangelical Christian credentials. And otherwise for Donald Trump, I mean, his children tend to be very good surrogates. Ivanka, they are bringing her out a lot. She was with him with the childcare announcement, and I think she accompanied him. I don't think she was on stage with him for Dr. Oz, but she was there with him, and she's speaking, you know, to Cosmo magazine about
well,
the child.
That wasn't a great moment.
No, it was not a great moment, but you know, she's doing all these women's magazines pieces, and she's one of those unique people where Chelsea Clinton is saying on The View, we're still good friends, we're going to remain good friends. You know, she seems to be almost in this protected status in the Trump orbit.
Isn't that extraordinary that Ivanka and Chelsea are friends, and in order for Hillary Clinton to get her husband to help her after she falls down in the street, she has to ask an aide to email another aide and see if he's available? Just a thought. All right, that's it for us. Goodbye, Scott.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, Hadass.
Bye.
Bye, Shane.
Bye.
Bye, Charlie.
Bye, Kristen.
Thank you to our producer, Bridget Mulcahy, and thank you to Bill Cookman, who's been creating the cool illustrations for each one of these episodes. And of course, thanks to you for listening. Talk to you next week. We love doing this podcast, and we really love hearing from you. So please keep the emails coming to nerdcast@politico.com and go to your favorite podcast app and leave a review. Thank you for listening.